Welcome to episode 100 of the Stage Left podcast. It's Chris Simpson here. I hope you are doing okay. What a journey it's been over the last 7 years to finally get to episode 100. And we have Dave Hemingway of the Beautiful South and now lead singer of Sunbirds coming up. What a 7 years it's been to get to 100 episodes. I've had huge life changes along the way and you've all been there along that journey with me. And you get quite reflective when you get to three figures, particularly when we're producing, you know, some of this content can be sometimes an hour and a half, 2 hours. Often it gets edited down, but it's been quite a journey kind of extracting that learning that we can all take into our day-to-day life. And also as young musicians, what we could be doing more of, what we could be doing less of to enhance our chances of getting to where we want to. We're going to be doing some new things going forward that actually sound really exciting, but I'm not going to say exactly what they are. But we've had some lovely feedback from the likes of Laura Barton from The Guardian, who said some really nice things about our Bill Ryder Jones episode that was quite recent. And we actually had people saying that that particular episode was the best episode of any podcast they'd ever heard. I don't know if that is the case or not, probably not, but thank you so much for the support that you've shown us over the last 100 episodes. And do drop us a DM on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, because sometimes we put these out into the world and we don't know who's listening or where they're from or how they're getting on in life. So do touch base with us. That'd be great. If anyone's going to Nebworth in a couple of weeks to see Liam Gallagher, are we there? So do reach out. It'd be good to meet a few of you because I know definitely there'll be some people who are. But listen, enough from me. This isn't about me. This is about the Stage Left musicians. We've got Dave Hemingway now. Thanks for listening for these 100 episodes and here's to the next 100. Enjoy.
Well, we had a lot of laughs, actually. In 20 years, we never argued more than 5 times, really. We just had a good time. Tell you what, the songwriters in bands get the money, and that creates a lot of arguments. But with us, you know, Beautiful South, Paul and Dave shared it all out. They were fantastic. So, therefore, we left the songwriting to the best people in the band that could do it. So you didn't have a drummer, someone like me, coming up who has never written a song in his life and saying, I've wrote a song, I want to put it on, I want my song there. So therefore, we didn't argue about money. And that creates a lot of arguments in bands.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Gorillaz, Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis, and David Bowie. It's an honour today to be joined by the iconic vocalist Dave Hemingway, initially starting out as drummer in the House Martins before becoming a founding member of the Beautiful South, singing lead on the likes of Song for Whoever and Little Time. Today we'll be discussing harmonies and singing those harmonies with Norman Cook, how arranging differs to songwriting, how to effectively divide up responsibilities within a band's dynamic, and hearing about Dave's new band Sunbirds, who have upcoming dates this summer. So it's a pleasure to say that guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Dave Hemingway. Thanks for joining today, Dave. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Good, good, good. So I just wondered, looking back to your youth, who were your kind of drummers that inspired you to want to pick up the sticks?
Yeah, my hero was always Keith Moon, because he didn't play by the rules, really. If you're a drummer, you're supposed to do a certain thing in a certain way. And he always did things differently from a young age, yeah.
And the next thing I think is important to highlight is that when you were a young musician coming through, there's probably people who kind of act formally or informally as mentors or people that kind of are there to kind of either be a critical friend or just to give you advice and kind of just look out for you. Who do you think was quite pivotal in your career that may not have got kind of the credit or the, you know, you never had an opportunity to mention that to? So was there anybody that you think shaped your career and you'd be in a different place now if it hadn't been for them in your early years?
It's going to be an obvious answer, but it's going to be my mum, really, because she was like, struggled for all her life with 3 jobs and trying to keep me and everything. And she always said, go for it, basically. She really did everything for me. And yeah, she always said, keep trying, which I did.
I'm sure every listener to this will think, oh, there was one band or one artist that I would buy their single the day it came out, or got really excited when they were returning. So when we go back to kind of your youth again, before you joined the House Martins, before they kicked off, what was that artist to you?
Well, Sex Pistols were fantastic. You know, I was 16 when they came out.
Wow.
And they were just like a different planet. I'm glad that God Save the Queen is hopefully going to be put out again tomorrow, because it should have been number one in 1977, and it should be number one again in 2022.
Did you ever see the Sex Pistols?
Yeah.
Well, you did. Okay. Well, some of us have heard kind of legends. I never saw the Sex Pistols. Could you, like, talk us through kind of the sights, the smells, the experiences of a gig like that? Was there, I guess it was exhilaration? Was there fear? Was there...
The big thing about the Sex Pistols is people thought they couldn't play. They thought they weren't good musicians, or they couldn't sing, or they couldn't do anything. Absolute rubbish. They were great. Absolutely fantastic. People said they couldn't play because they didn't want them to play. They thought, like, the left wings, it's rubbish. But they weren't rubbish. They were really good.
If you could relive a six-month period of your life again from your professional world, which period would you relive and why?
I played in bands that hadn't been successful. I was 26 when I joined the House Martins. At that age, you're thinking, okay, it's passed me by. I'm never going to be successful or something like that. And that particular year in 87 was really exciting, because suddenly you're on top of the pops and stuff. You're in a band that is successful. Things you'd never dream of as a kid. Everybody take a stand, join the caravan of love. Stand up, stand up, stand up, your brother. Your brother, don't you know? She's my sister. A great thing about the House Martins was we sang a cappella, and not many bands do that. You just put your instruments down and just sing. And Caravan of Love was an a cappella song, four-part harmonies. And it was really uplifting to sing a cappella at any gig. It was great.
Was it quite challenging to stay in tune at large gigs? I guess it really was dependent on fold-back monitors and that kind of thing, because there's live versions of you doing it and you absolutely nail every single harmony, and it must be so difficult to do that without any instrumentation.
What you've got to realise is it's about the rehearsal. I mean, we rehearsed that in Paul's living room, right, in Grafton Street in Hull, and just sang to each other without any sort of microphones or anything like that. If you can play quiet really well, then you can play loud really well. Because if you're good in a living room, you can be good in a stadium.
Yeah, it's very impressive. Obviously, quite a contrast to what he went on to do, Fatboy Slim. Talk about what your fondest memories of working with Norman Cook.
First memory of Norman is when I went to join the House Martins. He was the first guy who said, "Hello, nice to meet you. Great to have you here," sort of thing. He was such a nice bloke. And I thought that was very nice of him, sort of thing, because I didn't have to do that, but he was the first one to do that. And Norman always did the House Martins because he was Paul's mate and is playing bass, but he was always into his dance and stuff like that. So he took time off to be with the House Martins. And when that House Martins folded, he went back to his first love, which is the dance stuff. He was always a dance maestro sort of thing. He just took a bit of time off to play bass in the House Martins. Lovely bloke, absolutely fantastic, lovely guy.
And your first opportunities to sing lead, would that be around the time you did Build? You sang kind of the chorus on Build, and that's a shared vocal. And how did that come about that you were identified to be a singer? Because I think at that stage, you were just playing the drums and doing a bit of backing vocals.
Yeah, that's true. That wasn't my idea. Stano sang that bit in Build. But when we came to record it, Paul said, "I want Dave to do it." And I was very surprised because I didn't expect it. I didn't know. And Stan didn't know. I think he was a bit happy about it, really. But I went, "Oh, okay, so I'll go and do that bit then." And the recording, it went out well, obviously. But it was a surprise. Paul never said that to me. But, yeah, after that, it was when the House Martins stopped. He said, "Do you want to be in the next band, Beautiful South?" I assumed it was going to be as a drummer, but it wasn't that way. It was he wanted me as a singer, which again was another surprise.
I always thought Beautiful South as a little bit like Fleetwood Mac, with lots of different vocalists and male vocalists, female vocalists. How did you go about as a band dividing up the parts and deciding who was going to sing what? And did it ever come quite close to you singing very different parts to on other classics?
Well, I think when Paul and Dave brought the songs to the rehearsals and stuff, it was, became apparent, because we had three vocalists, right? Well, it became apparent which song would suit which voice. So Brennan, or it's up me, or so Paul, whatever. So we used to chop and change, really. And it was a good way of doing it because, yeah, we were lucky because we had so much good songs to choose from.
You've got a very beautiful voice, and it's a very iconic voice, I would say. And obviously some of the first lines of Song for Whoever, there's live recordings of you doing that, and just huge crowds singing along to that. Obviously, that's a classic song. What's your memories of recording that particular song? Because it's such a classic.
Well, I remember I did it because I didn't realise how important it was going to be, really. I had no fear because nobody said it was going to be a classic song, so I thought I'll just go for it. I remember being in a studio singing it and thinking, you know, I'll give it my best shot, of course, but I never expected it to be as important as it was, really. In a way, I suppose that was the best way to do it, because if you got a lot of pressure on and think, if someone has said this is going to be a career defining record and single and stuff, which it was, really. If someone had said that, I'd have been like, I probably couldn't do it.
I think it was the first single by Beautiful South, and you were straight on Top of the Pops, front and centre, performing. I think you had to mind back then. But how did you feel, almost physically, being at the front of the stage, fronting this band that, you know, is a really big deal at the time? Did you model your kind of performance on anyone, or did you feel out your depth? Did you feel confused being there? Did you feel in the zone? Just quite interesting to see, because you've come from the drums to the front of the stage, how you felt about that.
No, totally out of my depth, as you say, totally out of my depth. I was very happy being a drummer because drummers are drummers, and I was okay doing that. It wasn't my choice to be up front at all, and it was very difficult for me. Still is, to be honest. I've never been one for being up front or anything like that. I was happy being behind the scenes, starting the Beautiful South. Paul showed confidence in me.
Yeah.
So I believe in you. So I did the best I could. Yeah.
How did you prepare for large-scale gigs or gigs of high profile? So, for instance, Glastonbury on the Pyramid stage, or when you played Jules Holland's special show, which you knew was going to be viewed by millions of people live on BBC Two, or a lot of other high-profile gigs you did. Talk us through from waking up that morning through to going on stage and finishing the gig. And how would you make sure that you were in a good place by the time you came on stage? And what advice would you give to people feeling anxious in those times, and how would you map out that day to get the best performance in the evening?
That was a great show, by the way, as advice. Try not to think about it too much, because I'd say if you rehearse enough and you know the songs and what you're doing, then just go with that and think about the fact that it's like any gig. If you think about how many people you're playing to, then you're going to have a bit of a downfall, really. And I'm the worst to worry about stuff, believe me. There was one particular tour we did in America, and I was physically sick every time before I went on stage. About a minute before I went on stage, I was so wound up. So it was different for me in different sort of scenarios. But that Jules Holland thing, I was okay with that for some reason. I should have been more nervous, really, but I was okay with that.
You had some amazing guests. I think Sam from Sam and Dave was one of the guests, and James D. Bradfield. You sang with James D. Bradfield from The Mannix. Were there a lot of rehearsals with those two, or what, was that just kind of straight into it?
Nah, straight into it. And what I'll say about James D. Bradfield, you might not like me saying this, but I'm going to say this. He is such a quiet guy, really quiet. He's got this persona of, because he's the lead singer of Mannix Street Preachers and stuff. He is such a lovely, quiet guy. And that particular thing, he did Red Eyes with me. And he didn't have to play guitar because Dave Rothery was playing guitar. But he said, I can't stand there without a guitar on me. I've got to have a guitar in front of me because I don't know how to be, even though he wasn't playing, Dave was playing the guitar. But I said, I need my guitar. Well, I thought that sums me up, really. Sums him up. Sometimes you've got to think, wow, you're scared sometimes. No, I'm not calling him scared, because he couldn't stand there without his guitar and just sing. I'm saying that he wanted his little comfort of having his guitar. And that, to me, meant a lot.
So how would you advise bands to staying harmonious? Is it spending kind of dedicated time away from each other? Is it time being creative? What would you pinpoint something that you would say to a band? Because there's so many great bands that will split up, and therefore so much great music that goes unheard and or uncreated.
Well, we had a lot of laughs, actually. In 20 years, we never argued more than 5 times, really. We just had a good time. Tell you what, the songwriters in bands get the money, and that creates a lot of arguments. But with us, you know, Beautiful South, Paul and Dave shared it all out. They were fantastic. So, therefore, we left the songwriting to the best people in the band that could do it. So you didn't have a drummer, someone like me, coming up who has never written a song in his life and saying, I've wrote a song, I want to put it on, I want my song there. So, therefore, we didn't argue about money. And that creates a lot of arguments in bands.
What were your fondest memories, or memories at all, of recording A Little Time? Because that is a true classic, with the characterization of the two kind of main characters through it, how the song evolves throughout it. Do you remember recording the vocals for that? And what were your kind of memories of that particular session?
Yeah, I remember recording it, but again, I never realized at the time it was going to be such an important song. Because I remember recording it, but I didn't know it was going to be like put out there as a single or become a number one. So I didn't realize that. So it was only afterwards that you think, yeah. I remember more the video, to be honest. The video was like, yeah, that was fun. Yeah, because actually it wasn't, because you got yourself covered in flour and stuff like that. If you remember that.
Yeah, you know, classic video.
Yeah. So it was more about the video, really, because the video was really out there. And I think that helps the song, really. And then, but yeah, I didn't realize how big that song was going to become when I did it. No.
So after that stage, when you did realize that the next records you're going to be doing, they were going to be hit records, whatever you put out, really, because you were such a big band at the time, how did that feed into your mind when the red light went in the studio and you were having to, when you went into record, knowing that was going to be heard by?
We never thought, oh, this one's going to be a single. Apart from one song, which I would always say was a perfect temp. It sounded like a hit from day one. That particular song, I just knew it was going to be a hit because of the middle eight. But we never got it until actually Norman came back and helped us with it.
Did it?
He did the intro and ba-dum, ba-dum, perfect team, that sort of thing. That sort of thing. That was Norman. And he made the song in a way. it was needed something. When he came up with that initial thing, it made the song, and that, I always thought that was going to be a hit. We offered it to Tom Jones, by the way.
Really? That, I could see how that would work.
Yeah, and he turned it down. Idiot. No, I can imagine.
That's
obviously, Paul sang it and it did great, but apart from that song, we just wait on stuff and, you know, we're all good songs because Paul's a great songwriter, Paul and Dave.
Yeah, and what would someone working with Paul learn that they might not learn from working with anyone else?
He was very exact, very with lyrics. He was like, it had to be right. Everything had to be right. If it was just a little bit off, we were in trouble. He wrote it a certain way and he wanted it a certain way. So if I was singing one of his songs and I did little inflections, I was in trouble because he went, no, Dave, that's not how I wrote it. It's different. And so I had to learn all that. It was very exact. He was a total perfectionist, which is good because that's how he wanted his songs to be. So that's how they were. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, he was a perfectionist. Probably still is.
Yeah. Which gig, if you could, that you played, would you most love to go back and be in the audience for?
Glastonbury, you know, on the main stage, supporting REM. The sun was going down and it was about, I don't know, 7 o'clock at night. And it was just fantastic. It was one of those moments where you think, what am I doing here, really? Do I deserve this? Do I deserve to be on this stage with these people? And knowing all these fantastic bands are around, it just makes you feel a bit, yeah, it was fantastic. It was one of the moments of my life, really. And yeah, what can I say?
It's a beautiful answer. How did you maintain a kind of raw emotion with a song when you've played it hundreds and hundreds of times? Like, is there a case that you ever think, oh, I've got to sing song forever again, or whatever it might be? Like, how do you stay connected to that song? Do you think about the lyrics? Do you just concentrate on what you're doing? Or how do you stay connected to a song that you played so many times?
Now, that's an easy question for me. That's an easy question because I always remember when the song was brought into the rehearsal room and when we heard it for the first time, I always think, sing it like you sang it for the very first time. See it that way, with the same feeling, same emotion. Do that every time that you play it in front of any audience, and you won't be going far wrong. Because imagine, just think about what the emotions you felt when you first sang that song, when it wasn't rehearsed up and it wasn't the best, but think, oh, that's a great song. Sing it the same way. And to me, that was a no-brainer because every time I sang Song Forever, I sang it with my heart, you know, forever. That was it. I'll never sing it again, by the way, but there you go.
I was going to say, is that it now?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I'm singing new songs now, and I'm enjoying that. But I'm not knocking the old songs, and I'm thinking they're fantastic. But answer to your question, like I said, I always remember singing every time, sing it like it always felt first time you sang it. And to me, that was always special.
Excellent. That's a fantastic answer. What song that isn't one of your own makes you choke up when you hear it?
You Do Something to Me by Paul Weller. I think it's a beautiful love song. There's a lot of beautiful love songs out there. And Paul has written a lot of them. I'd say Don't Meet Your Heroes. I did meet Paul Weller, you know, and he was such a nice guy. Fantastic. Lovely guy. And yeah, and that to me is a great love song. You Do Something to Me. I think it's up there with the best, really.
And what's something you said no to you wish you would have said yes to? A bit like the Tom Jones thing, really. It's like that would have been a perfect hit for him as well as it was for Beautiful South.
It wasn't me, really, but I think the house lines that we got offered to support David Bowie at Wembley, and Paul said no. Obviously, that was Paul saying no, not me saying no.
Yeah.
I'd just joined the band. I'm thinking, that'd be nice, you know. But I don't know why Paul said no, but he did. So that's not me saying no, but I'm going to digress with that one.
Nice.
So we could have done that. That would have been nice.
And you've got some shows coming up with the Sunbirds in Doncaster, yep. Leopard. You're playing the whole new Adelphi Club. You're playing the York Crescent as well. Are you rehearsing yet? That's the first question. The second question is, what's one thing that you do that just reduces that nervousness by 5 or 10% and be confident on stage for those shows coming up?
Well, first off, we are playing new material. We're not going to play anything, older songs. It's all going to be new Sunbirds material. That's it. So sorry, everybody, if you're coming along, but that's it. I think it's important for us to play new stuff now. Paul's playing new stuff. We're going to play some new stuff. I've done a lot of playing the old stuff, and I don't want to do it anymore, really. As great as the songs are, and they are great songs, don't get me wrong, they're fantastic songs, but I just don't want to do it anymore. I want to play some new stuff. And what was the second part? Being nervous. Yeah, I'm always nervous. And yeah, it's going to be tough. It's always a trial for me. But I'm thinking, well, go out there and enjoy it. Because I tell you what, you should enjoy life. And if you're in a band and you go out there and sing, you should enjoy it. So go for that.
Listen, Mick Jagger said that if you aren't nervous before going on stage, you should stop doing it. So I think that's good advice, and it's coming from him as well. If you had one more hour in the day, other than sleep, what would you do for that hour? Yeah.
Well, I'll talk to you for another hour.
Great answer. Now, listen, good luck with the shows coming up over the summer. You've sung on songs that have been loved and going to be listened to for generations to come, and that for any musician, really, that's the musical legacy, that songs can be listened to long after we're about. So thanks for your wisdom, your insight, your advice. Best of luck with the upcoming shows, and thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Hey, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
This episode was mixed and edited by Bastian Hughes, Bastianhues. And that's little Eliza Day, my baby, 4 month old, who's making a bit of noise in the background, giving a endorsement to Bastian. You should get in touch with him on Instagram, whether you need support with your mixing, your editing, your scoring, or your website design, Bastianhues. He's doing a great job.